This episode of In the Drink is brought to you by Melio Payments, a digital payments platform for small businesses. This week, Melio has provided us with an uplifting story from one of the small businesses they work with named Fabrizia Spirits in Salem, New Hampshire. Normally, Fabrizia Spirits would be producing a line of all-natural limoncello and ready-to-drink cocktails. But what they've done in order to respond to this pandemic is they've actually retrofitted their facility to produce hand sanitizers. And they're donating, they made a commitment to donate at least 7,000 bottles to medical staff and first responders. Fabrizia is actually asking if you work in a hospital, fire, or police station, you can email them directly at info@fabriziaspirits.com and they will get you some hand sanitizer. I want to give a big thanks to Phil and Nick Mastroianni for the work that they're doing, showing the creativity, ingenuity, and just goodwill of rising to the occasion. Thanks so much, guys, and everyone at Fabrizia Spirits and Hand Sanitizer. You've also uplifted my day reading your story and hearing about the good work you're doing. You're listening to In the Drink. I'm your host, Joe Campanelli. Usually about now, I would tell you that when I'm not hosting In the Drink, you can find me at Lalu or Fausto, my restaurants in Brooklyn, New York. But as you probably know, our restaurants and so many others are closed due to the coronavirus pandemic. This season is going to have a new focus on how experts in the wine world are coping with this new normal. This season, we're going to be coming to you on Tuesdays and Fridays, so make sure you subscribe to get those episodes as soon as they come out. My first episode back is with the New York Times chief wine critic, Eric Asimov. He's been doing all of his coverage, not by traveling around the world meeting with great winemakers, but by speaking with them from his own apartment. Nonetheless, he's produced a series of great articles. I've read every single one of them since this pandemic started, and I hope you enjoy this interview as much as I've been enjoying Eric's writing. Eric, thank you so much. I really appreciate you taking the time to do this.
It's my pleasure, Joe.
I was wondering if you could tell us what an average workday for you was like before the coronavirus and what an average work day is like for you now.
Well, we were really coming into a period of intense planned travel for me. I had a number of trips, a number of stories that I wanted to do. And really one of the joys of my job is being able to visit people at the source, go to vineyards, go to places, see firsthand the culture of which the wine is an expression. And that is so enriching and so necessary to being able to understand and talk about wine. And of course, that's all out now. And so basically my daily schedule consists of going to my home office from my, we have two adjoining apartments, one of which has been my office for about 10 years. So it's not strange in that respect. I'm used to working from home, but there's none of the ordinary give and take in life, going to see people, to talk to them directly, to taste wine with them, no going to restaurants, all of which are just crucial to my creative process. So I've got to come up with other ways of thinking about wine for the near time, I hope.
Was there a date that the New York Times told everyone to, you just have to work from home at this point, or was it sort of phased?
Well, it was the second week of March, first or second week of March, where we started talking about it. And there were some practice sessions, I guess, for the people who are used to being in the newsroom, the editors and the people who really put the newspaper together every day. And, they had to work out remote systems in a way that was far more difficult than it was for me. The only things that I've really had to put a stop to are our wine panel tastings, which, require a bunch of people gathering together and tasting together. So that's kind of sad for me.
Those are always so much fun. I love going to those. Yeah.
March 12th was the last day that I went to a restaurant. And that just sticks in my mind.
What restaurant was it?
It was Le Crocodile.
Great.
And I remember my wife and I were meeting my son and his partner, who ended up staying home because he had just gotten back from a business trip. And, he framed it as an abundance of caution because somebody who was on that trip had gotten sick. So it was just the three of us. And I remember, what was that, 5-6 weeks ago, just wondering about all the people at the restaurant and, we're all still close together and should we be shaking hands and or doing elbow bumps or whatever. But it everything very quickly changed after that.
That was one of the last restaurants I went to as well. I went for my birthday on February 26th.
Yeah.
And at that time, it wasn't even a thought that we shouldn't be in a restaurant.
I had come back from Charleston and I had just gone to La Palais de New York to write a story about it because it was the 20th anniversary. And you had this gathering of, maybe 600 people in a room. I think it was March 7th. And there was zero discussion except by me, because I was asking people, do you feel a little uncomfortable being in this crowd? Nobody did. And it's kind of astounding that that event managed to carry off without, at least I haven't heard of anybody getting sick because of it.
I was there as well. And I remember I was giving people the old elbow bump and getting weird looks and seeing French winemakers do the triple kiss.
Right. So how is everything going with your places? Are you doing takeout, or are you completely closed down? Or
we're completely closed down. We did take out for about 5 days at Fausto after the mandatory shutdown of dine-in restaurants. We wanted to go through the food that we had in stock, but it was really mostly my partner, Chef Aaron, and our GM. We didn't want to have people get on the subway and travel a long distance. The majority of the people who work in the kitchen at Fausto and Lalu have to travel on the subway a great distance to get there. And we just didn't feel right about doing that. I wonder how has the coronavirus affected the way you go about covering the industry? Because I know that you're not doing the tasting panel anymore, but you're still putting out great articles. I loved the recent one on the definition of natural wine. I thought that was really well done. I imagine that one probably had you started that some time ago, but.
No, actually, that's the first article that I've done since the pandemic began, which had no angle at all on the pandemic. And it was actually, it's something that I think about a lot, but I believe the French definition was issued during the pandemic. So, it's kind of a rare example of a current event that has nothing at all to do with the pandemic. And, the only odd thing was interviewing people either by Zoom or trying to find them from wherever isolated place they had gone to. But, it's cast such a pall and a different sort of framework on the business. So it's kind of colored almost everything that I'm doing. For example, I try to keep in mind that the New York Times readership is pretty general. You know, it ranges from people who just want to know what sort of wine to pick up on their way home to connoisseurs and collectors who know a lot more than I do about their very narrow specialty. And I try to keep, in general, keep in mind that not everybody wants to pay $100 or more for a bottle of wine, not to mention $50 or $40. But that's true even more so now. I mean, people who are out of work, who have had hours or pay cut back, who just want, it almost seems disrespectful to be talking about expensive wines right now.
And so do you picture the majority of your coverage for the time being to be coronavirus related, or to just sort of keep that in mind that we're going to be focusing more on more affordable wines?
Yeah, I think I have to keep the coronavirus and how it's changed our world very much in mind. Not every article is going to be strictly focused on that, but I do a monthly wine school column. And part of that column in general is recommending a specific genre of wine every month and suggesting a few examples that people can go out and buy. But people can't shop in the same way that they were doing before. So I have to be a little bit more flexible in the wines that people are going to get. And even if they can't do that, maybe there's another way for people to participate, maybe by cooking something and just picking some wines that they think would go with that dish, because it's very, that column in particular is very much a two-way discussion. And you just have to try to alter things and make it a little bit more convenient and doable in our current situation. And then, you know, as the coronavirus, as the shutdown continues to affect the whole culture of food and wine, just in terms of business, you have to pay attention to that.
I love how that article is. It really is a conversation between you and the readers, and you don't see that frequently in other outlets. And I've seen you adjust future tastings based on, or future wine schools based on feedback you've gotten from readers on previous ones. I think it's a great column. I love it. I look forward to it.
You know, thank you. Completely coincidentally, the unit for wine school was a complete switch up, and I had, instead of suggesting wines to people, I had asked everybody to roast a chicken and pick out some wines that they thought were going to go with that. And that idea and suggestion came before the lockdown, and it's turned out to be the perfect lockdown assignment, you know. So we'll see what happens next.
That works. What is your, or is it not revealed yet, your roast chicken wines?
Well, that will come out. It should be published on Thursday. But the spoiler for roast chicken is that it's pretty much impossible to go wrong. You know, it's like every wine goes with roast chicken. So I just wanted to see what people would come up with. And there are some obvious choices: Burgundy, Rhone, Northern Rhone wines, Beaujolais, things like that. But I personally, I tried four different wines: dry German Riesling, a Montepulciano d'Abruzzo. The third wine was a Nebbiolo that was blended with just a little bit of Dolcetto, and a California Carignan. And you know, they were all pretty good.
This episode is brought to you once again by 750. 750 has been such a fantastic partner for In the Drink. I'm really excited to have them on board again this season. One of the things I really love about 750 is not only can you browse a huge selection of wines and spirits and beers, but you can also place the orders directly through the website. You can build and place those orders via desktop or mobile. And then later, you can always access your previous orders, which saves you a lot of time. Reach out to Matt at 750.com, that's 750 spelled out, and he can help you submit your first order if you need assistance. I also want to share with you that 750 has just launched a new exciting feature on the marketplace, and it was launched specifically to support buyers during this difficult period. Basically, it's a live chat that allows you to ask questions on the spot so that you can find everything you need and order with confidence. 750.com, find everything you need all in one place, search and order all products from all distributors all online. So I guess on a personal note, aside from the column, how has this affected your own, you know, personal wine drinking? Have you been going through your cellar? Are you still buying wine? How are you sourcing wine?
Well, you know, luckily I live in Manhattan, and you know, despite all that's going on, wine is still being delivered. And you know, we have a really good network for online shopping in New York City, so I'm able to get whatever wines I need. And you know, because I'm still working, I'm still writing, I still have to be tasting a lot of different wines. So the luxury of drinking through my, I'm going to say, cellar in quotation marks, because you know, for a journalist living in Manhattan in small digs, you know, you're basically, you've got a little wine refrigerator, you got a bunch of boxes around, you've got wine stash. I don't really have access to my wine that's stashed at a friend's house. But you know, I'm buying wine for columns that I'm writing about.
And you don't accept wine samples, right?
You know, people send me samples, and in an ideal world, nobody would send samples, but I can't stop everybody. And, you know, the compromise that I've made to be able to exist within New York Times ethical standards is that I don't write or review wines that I receive as samples, only wines that we purchase retail. And that's just, you know, the idea is not to, you know, privilege people who are sending me samples. It would be very easy just to write about the wine that's sent to me and never have to buy anything, but that just doesn't seem right or fair. And I'm personally privileged to work for an institution that has the resources to finance that sort of ethical stand.
And I'm sure a lot of the wines that maybe you're excited about, that I know that I'm excited about, probably the wineries don't have budgets to be shipping samples around the world.
Yeah, and that's absolutely true. You know, most of the samples that are shipped come from, you know, big commercial producers who have the marketing department and the shipping department and the extra wine to send. And, you know, that especially is a good reason not to depend on those sort of samples. And I'm sure I have a lot of readers who would prefer that I would write about those kind of wines, because one of the most frequent complaints that I get is that people can't find the wines that I'm writing about. And I've tried to break away from the notion that the role of the wine writer is only to write about wines that everybody has access to, and thinking that it's, you know, it's actually really good to know that other wines exist in the world. And even if you can't find them immediately, you can file them away in your mind for the day when, you know, we can all go to restaurants or we can travel and we can happen upon these sort of wines, just as, you know, we might be interested in what's happening in the theater in London, even though we're not there. One day we'll get there, we hope.
Yeah, I hope so. And in the meantime, you know, I really did love your article on the comfort wines, the wines that give you personal comfort, and that Eric Texier Northern Rhone Syrah one that I love quite a bit as well. Are there other wines that you didn't include? Because I know you also gave some room for other, you know, for other people to give their comforting wines.
You know, I think there is definitely a tendency to retreat to the familiar you know, wines that you've had a great deal of pleasure of from in the past. And, you know, you just want that because our times are so, we live with a lot of anxiety right now, you know, whether it's because of a fear of disease or economic fear or just fear not being able to get on with our lives and see our friends and do the things we love. And, you know, that's, I think wine plays the same role for people that comfort foods do. And I have a lot of wines that I love, and I've been really, you know, struggling with myself a little bit not to indulge myself because I have to, you know, I have to keep exploring and learning. And that's, you know, that's basically my job. So if I were just to continually drink familiar wines right now, you know, I wouldn't get any work done.
I remember thinking to myself, you know, I've spent this last year working on this Italian wine book, and it's been my whole career with Italian wines, and how I really want to learn more about what's going on in Australia and Chile and South Africa. And I think I need to spend some more time branching out, especially to non-European, because I've been to wine regions in a bunch of European countries, but not non-European countries. And now I find myself, just as you said, you know, going back to this great Chianti producer that I visited a few times, or Barolo, or something that, or even more like Langhe Nebbiolo than Barolo. The fancy wines aren't as comforting.
Yeah. It's always a dilemma for people who are professionally connected to wine. You, on the one hand, you want to go deep and really explore and understand a particular region or a particular style. But then there's so much else in the world that is worth knowing about. And, you know, it's one of my frustrations that I can't go as deep as I would like sometimes, because I have to really go travel widely in wine.
So if you can envision a time after this, when we sort of return to us all going back to restaurants and going back to the office to do work, and you traveling to visit people in person, what sort of lasting effects do you think this time will have just on the wine industry in general?
You know, this is the greatest fear I have, you know, and it's true in wine and food. You know, this whole experience has posed an existential threat for small wine producers, small restaurants, family businesses, family estates, all of these things that I have cherished all these years. And my fear is that bigger companies, corporations with resources will kind of gobble up all of these small estates, similarly in the restaurant business. In the restaurant business, it'll be more of a replacement idea. But I just think that would be, you know, catastrophic for the culture of humanity, certainly in the U.S. and around the world. And it would be terrible for wine. You know, I think that over the long term, new wineries, new restaurants will be able to emerge. But when you think of the damage, the human casualty, you know, not just in terms of the disease, but the economic casualties, it's just, it's going to be catastrophic. That's my fear.
Yeah, that's a sobering thought. And I was wondering if you had anything that has given you hope or inspiration when you speak to these producers. Is there been anything inspirational that you've come across during this last time?
Well, I mean, I feel like I'm inspired every day. And, you know, it's not necessarily people I'm talking to, but certainly the way people have rushed to help each other, whether it's medical workers or people who are still working in the hospitality business who, you know, I mean, it's crazy to say, but people are risking their lives getting on a subway. And, you know, I know most people don't have a lot of choice in that, but I see people you know, in New York City, just providing food, delivering food, delivering their medical expertise. And that's very inspiring. And of course, you know, in wine, people still have to tend their vineyards and do their vineyard work. And the way that people who work in agriculture and work directly with nature, I find very inspiring. People who are working in conjunction with nature, I find that, always find that very inspiring.
Thank you so much. It's been such a pleasure to chat with you. And I hope you stay safe and continue to put out great work and drink great wine.
Joe, thank you very much. And wishing that you and your family and all your loved ones are safe and well.
Thank you. Take care.
Okay. Appreciate thanks it. A lot.
Thank you so much for listening to this first episode of the new season of In the Drink. I also want to give a big thank you to our producer, Jessamine Molly of Seaplane Armada, and our sponsors, Melio and 750. If you like this episode, it would really mean the world to me if you could subscribe and you can rate us on Apple Podcasts. And if you have any thoughts or questions, feel free to shoot us an email at inthedrinkpod@gmail.com. Thanks again so much for listening, and we'll see you on Friday with Pascaline Le Peltier.